On January the 28th, 1986, the space shuttle Challenger exploded in midair with the loss of all seven crew. It was a multi-ethnic crew, including Krista McAuliffe, who was to be the first teacher in space. And it happened in full view of all their families and excited school children and millions of others watching live. It's one of those unforgettable events where many people can recall exactly where they were and what they were doing when they heard the news about it. I certainly can. President Reagan had planned to speak live to the crew that evening during his annual State of the Union address to the American people. But instead, he found himself leading the nation in their grief and shock. There was, of course, an inquiry. What on earth had led to this disaster? How could this possibly have happened? Who was to blame? People at NASA or someone else? The inquiry panel did their work thoroughly. There were dramatic moments during its hearings as one key fact after another came to light. But when all was said and done, the conclusion was simple. The space shuttle was and is the most complex machine that man has ever built. But the Challenger disaster was caused by one single disastrous wrong decision. Here's what happened. The shuttle is launched with the aid of two powerful booster rockets. And each of these rockets is built up of sections which have to be joined together. And in each of the joins there is a rubber O-ring seal. If that seal fails, gas at a temperature of thousands of degrees will come spurting out with potentially catastrophic consequences. And when the air outside is very cold, this rubber becomes brittle and it won't seal the gap. That day the shuttle was launched in a temperature of 2 degrees Celsius. That is cold for Florida and much colder than any previous shuttle launch. At first, all seemed well, but appearances were deceptive. Less than 1 minute into the flight, gas had begun escaping from one of the joints on the right-hand booster rocket. A small flame appeared, and rapidly it grew larger. Within another 10 seconds, that flame had burned a hole in the shuttle's external fuel tank, causing the escape of a huge mass of liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. Another 10 seconds later, as all the world saw, the shuttle exploded in a giant fireball. But the bitterest side of the tragedy was that the NASA authorities had been warned that exactly this could happen. They had their warnings. The booster rockets were produced by a company called Thiokol, and their engineers were aware that there was a problem with the O-ring seals. Their inspection reports and their lab tests were very worrying. For the past year, an engineer who rejoiced in the name of Roger Boisjoli had been writing memos warning his superiors that if this cold weather problem was not attended to, there could be serious consequences, up to and including the loss of a mission. And on the night of January the 27th, a meeting was held to discuss whether the launch should go ahead. As the experts sat around late into the night, arguing about what to do, the shuttle was standing on the launch pad in temperatures well below freezing. This was not just a theoretical exercise now. This could be no academic discussion about the low temperature properties of rubber. No, this could mean life or death. The engineers from Thiokol urged a delay until the weather was warmer. The managers overruled them. The choice was made. The launch went ahead. And the rest is history. One decision, one wrong decision, one disaster. They had the warnings, serious, sober warnings from people who knew what they were talking about. Warnings based on the evidence in front of them, but warnings they chose to ignore. And so they made a decision that spelled death for seven people. In this story in Mark's Gospel, the question that is raised is even more serious than that. Is it possible that a decision could be more important than life or death? Yes, it is, if the consequences go beyond this life on earth. Who do people say I am? Jesus asks. The most important question we have to get right. For some people today, it seems, it's a question for academic discussion. Something to give their opinion on around a dinner table, or late at night over coffee in a hall of residence, or to produce a glossy TV programme about. Who do you think Jesus really was? Does the answer matter? Does it matter more than any other topic for idle discussion? Yes, it does, because bluntly, our answer will determine if we live or die in the world to come, whether we go to heaven or to hell. The question being discussed by Jesus' disciples as they sit there by the roadside is even bigger than the one the experts had to answer at the Kennedy Space Center that night. And with all my heart, I urge you to get the answer right. We've seen that Mark's concern in this part of his gospel is to show us how slowly Jesus' own disciples arrive at the right answer. Even these 12 men who have lived with Jesus for a long time now and have seen all the evidence don't seem able to reach a conclusion. There is a pattern in Mark's writing here where he shows us the disciples being so slow on the uptake, being spiritual half-wits, in fact, as we saw last week. That was the point of the very odd miracle story, the one in Bethsaida, where the blind man is healed in two stages. We looked at it last week and we read the story again a few minutes ago. At first, you remember, this man can only see people looking like trees walking about. Nothing is clear. Nothing looks right. It takes, as it were, two close encounters with Jesus before he can see clearly. And through that story, Mark is telling us that only a miracle from Jesus can properly open someone's eyes to the truth of who he is. And it's only now, at last, that one of the disciples finally arrives at something like the right answer. Tonight we follow Jesus and the group as they move further north from Bethsaida, 25 miles up to the region of Caesarea Philippi. As far as we can tell, they've never been here before. The gospel writers don't record Jesus doing much public ministry in this region. It's an interlude of peace where Jesus takes his disciples away on a kind of retreat. And it's an interesting place that they go to. It's a great place for a break, actually, right away from the Jewish crowds. A beautiful green oasis on the slopes of Mount Hermon, around the headwaters of the River Jordan. One time there was a temple to the pagan god Pan there. More recently, the Romans have moved in, rebuilt the town, now renamed in honour of Caesar Augustus, who originally added this area to Herod's territory. And Herod Philip has his palace in this place. And so it is here, in an area devoted to the pagan gods, and a town whose name devotes it to Lord Caesar, that the true identity of Jesus will finally be made clear. Here, perhaps as they pause for food, sitting on the grass beside the roadside, as his followers gather around him, and it's Jesus who opens up the conversation. Verse 27, who do people say that I am? The crucial question. And immediately it becomes clear that there are plenty of answers on offer. Verse 28, they replied, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others, one of the prophets. Jesus' identity is a hot topic. It could hardly be otherwise, given all that he's been doing. Even excluding the miracles that only the disciples have seen, there have been a host of amazing events, some of them right under the noses of the authorities, starting with the healing of the man lowered through the roof back in chapter 2, which took place right in front of a visiting panel of religious experts. Of course everyone is talking about Jesus. And not just because of what he has done, but equally because of what he said. There is no doubt whatever, this man speaks with authority. He's not just passing on other people's ideas, which is all that an ordinary teacher does, after all. The only doubt is whose authority does he carry? Does it come from God, or does it come from the devil? Oh yes, there are plenty of ideas. There always have been plenty of ideas about Jesus. First up, the disciples say, some people think you're John the Baptist. Well, they'd be in good company if they think that, because that's what King Herod himself thinks. Chapter 6, verse 16. Especially worrying in his case, since he is the one who had John beheaded. He thinks John's come back to haunt him in the person of Jesus. Now, everyone knows John was killed. He was a popular figure. So this answer has to assume that he's somehow risen from the dead. Why would people think this? Well, Jesus and John did have certain things in common. As cousins through their mothers, they may have looked alike. They were both popular preachers with a band of disciples and a radical message of repentance. They both appeared and disappeared rather mysteriously. And they both wound up the authorities. But on the other hand, John never did any miracles. And if people actually listened to him, they would know that his main ministry was to prepare the way for someone greater who was to come. But Jesus never pointed to any other man. He never hinted at anyone who was to follow. His ministry, both his teaching and his miracles, pointed people exclusively to himself. So what about option number two, Elijah? Now, Elijah is a really interesting possibility. He was one of the most dynamic of Old Testament prophets, living during the reigns of some really terrible kings in Israel around 800 years earlier. But the key point about Elijah is that the very last Old Testament prophet, Malachi, foretold that Elijah would be sent by God to prepare the way for the day of the Lord, the great day when he would intervene in human history and bring in his judgment and his eternal reign. Malachi 4 verse 5 says, "See, I will send you the prophet Elijah before that great and dreadful day of the Lord comes." And so faithful Jews were always watching for the appearance of this great prophet, this Elijah figure, who would herald the dawning of the new age that they were longing for. And so they thought, maybe this Jesus is the promised Elijah and God is about to start moving again in our nation. In fact, what people don't seem to realize is that these two options are really one and the same. Option one, John. A radical prophet who wears a hair cloak and a leather belt, has an eccentric diet, spends a lot of time in the desert, and says he's preparing for a greater one who will follow him. Option two, Elijah. A radical prophet who wears a hair cloak and a leather belt, has an eccentric diet, spends a lot of time in the desert, and was prophesied to return and prepare for God, who will follow him. Doesn't that suggest anything? Yes, John the Baptist is the Elijah who was to come. And that is exactly what Jesus says about him. As we will see in July, I hope, when we eventually get into chapter 9. This isn't about reincarnation, of course. The point is that Elijah's promised ministry is seen in John the Baptist. John is the Elijah who was to come, to return, to prepare the way for God's coming. And what does that make Jesus? Here is one more jigsaw piece of evidence about Jesus' identity. John, Elijah, both great prophets, yes, but clearly neither of them is Jesus. And so on to option three, a prophet, just one of the prophets, okay? We can see he doesn't quite fit the bill for Elijah, but perhaps God has sent back one of the others. What all of these options do is put Jesus in the category of prophets. And there are plenty of those, some great, some not so great. But by this theory, Jesus is simply the latest in a long list. It's a supporting role. And prophets were men and women. And God spoke through them. But if you miss what they say, well, like buses, there'll be another one along in a minute. Well, say the disciples, these are the options that people are coming up with. They might well have added, there are other people who think you're demon-possessed, notably the Pharisees. Oh, and don't forget your family, they just think you're insane. Perhaps they're too polite to throw that in, but they easily could have done. All sorts of people with all kinds of ideas. Some basically friendly, some frankly unfriendly. Some thinking they're doing you a great honour, Jesus, by saying you are a prophet. But is it true? And now Jesus comes to the real point of the conversation. But what about you? He asks. Who do you say I am? Have you guys reached a decision yet yourselves? After all, you've seen more of me, heard more of me than anyone else. Let's turn the spotlight on you. What do you say? And Peter comes out with it. You are the Christ. In a flash of God-given inspiration, he recognizes that here in front of him, this friend sitting there on that rock is the unique messenger of God. Not a prophet, but the Christ. The word Peter uses is Mashiach, the Messiah, the word that means anointed one. In Old Testament times, there were various special people who were anointed with oil to represent their appointment to a special God-given task, a special status. Prophets were anointed, priests were anointed, kings were anointed. But later, when people talk about the Messiah, the Christ, the anointed one who is to come, they have in mind the promises God has made about a future kingly ruler, descended in right line from King David, who will answer the hopes of the nation and bring in a rule of perfect justice and perfect peace. The Messiah, not one of a long line, not one among many, but one. Finally, after so long, after so much blundering around in the dark, the disciples have got there, or at least one of them has. It's the right answer at last. Jesus, the Christ, God's coming King. It's the right answer. But after all that we've read in the last few chapters of Mark, remembering how slow the disciples have been to get this far, we'll hardly be surprised to find that they still have some way to go. And that's what Jesus clearly has in mind when he says what he says next. Verse 30, Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him. This is exactly what he has said to people whom he has healed in the last year or so. Don't tell anyone. Now, in our publicity-hungry generation, it always sounds very odd hearing those words. Surely all publicity is good publicity. But Jesus doesn't think so. He knows that even Peter's moment of inspiration is still a long way short of the full truth. Peter and the others have no idea what Jesus' messiahship will actually mean. In fact, with this verse, we've arrived at the very hinge point of Mark's gospel. So far, the story has all been about identifying who Jesus is. Mark himself has told us in the very first verse of his gospel. He gave us the answer. He announced the message as the beginning of the gospel about Jesus Christ, the Son of God. And since chapter 1, verse 1, we have been waiting for someone to recognize him. So far, no one has. Ironically, actually, it's the demons who've got closest. But now, at last, Peter has got there. This is the turning point. And from here on, the story will be all about why Jesus came. What does it mean to say that he is the Christ, the Messiah, now that we've got this far? And it turns out that Jesus' ideas on that score are very different from Peter's. And we'll see more about that next week. But for now, just look at verse 31. He then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, chief priests, and teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. Here is why Jesus doesn't want the disciples spreading the news that Messiah is here. Because this is not at all the Messiah they are expecting. And it's not the Messiah they even want. This is a Messiah who has to suffer. Literally, the Greek just reads, it is necessary for him to suffer. It cannot be avoided. It cannot be ducked. He must suffer. He must be rejected. He must die. It is necessary. This is precisely what he has come to do. Jesus' death is not misfortune. It is not accident. It is quite deliberate. It is the great climax of his life, not the great disaster. And if you haven't got a Christ who dies for our sins and rises again in triumph and glory, then you have no Christ at all. Don't tell anyone about me, he says. And no wonder. You see, there are a lot of people who will follow Peter and the others up to verse 29. Yes, Jesus is a prophet. That's absolutely true. He is. A prophet is someone who brings messages from God, and Jesus most emphatically does that. No one ever spoke like this man, before or since. A prophet he is. And yes, Jesus is the Messiah. Even Muslims go this far. They agree wholeheartedly with the idea of Nabi Isa, the prophet Jesus, one prophet among many. And they call Jesus Isa al-Masih, Jesus the Messiah. But the Messiah they believe in is not the one the Bible tells us about. He is merely a human Messiah who does not suffer and emphatically does not die and cannot rise from the dead. Messiah then becomes just a word for someone special. And it can mean whatever you want it to mean. Plenty of people get called Messiah in that sense, even now. Nelson Mandela or a Barack Obama, see the passionate crowds. Or for that matter, if you're from Newcastle, a Kevin Keegan. In fact, you can call whoever you like a Messiah. But it doesn't make him the real thing. And today we're being told over and over again about all the similarities between Christians and Muslims. About how we both believe in one all-powerful God and how we both honour the name of Jesus the Messiah. I'm sorry, but it's not true. If you cut Jesus down to the size of a prophet, you do him no honour at all. And if you say he is no God, but merely a man, you are insulting him. And you are denying the truth that God has revealed. But now, what about you? Who do you say Jesus is? This is not some academic discussion starter. Like with that group gathered on the night before the Challenger launch. This is a life or death decision. It's a decision with deadly consequences. You can choose to call Jesus whatever you like. You can join those who said he was mad, if you like. You can join those who made him a great teacher, if you like. You can call him another in a long line of prophets, if you like. You can call him a special messenger or your own kind of Messiah, if you like. But in the end, the time will come when you have to face the consequences of your choice. The real Jesus, the true Messiah, came to suffer and die. That's what Peter hasn't understood yet. And that is what the Muslim or the Hindu has not grasped. That he came to die in our place, to suffer the sentence that we deserve for rebelling against God. It's only that death that puts us right with a God who is just and perfect and rightly demands a penalty for our sin. It's only because Jesus is a suffering Messiah, a dying Christ, that we can have any hope at all. What else are you going to offer to God? Who do you say Jesus is? Have you met the real Christ? Getting this answer wrong means more than life or death, you see. It means being cut off from God forever. But abandon all other hope. Believe in his death. Trust the real Jesus Christ in his death. And we will live. This isn't about having gone to church all your life or being taught certain things as you grew up. That's no good. That won't save you. Have you met the real Christ? Do you know him? Can't pretend this doesn't matter, that one opinion is just as good as another, that your sincerity will save you. Some say this, some say something else, and no doubt everyone has good intentions. No. This decision makes all the difference. What choice are you making? And if you do know the real Christ, and you do belong to him, then don't be taken in. Don't be deluded into thinking that there is any other Jesus than this one. Don't be fooled by people who say they honour Jesus as a teacher, as a guru, as a prophet, as an inspired man of learning. No one honours Jesus like that, because that isn't Jesus. That is not the real Jesus. And we have only one Jesus Christ to trust, to believe in, to honour. And this is the Christ that we love and proclaim.